Hi, this is Charlene, your host for Soul Sciences, the place where your inner experience meets outer exploration, or your inner exploration meets outer experience. Thanks for joining today's program of Soul Sciences. Hello, listeners. Today I have with me a woman named Linda Strader. She's coming to us from Arizona, and Linda has the distinction of being one of the first female firefighters in the U.S. Linda, welcome to the show. I'm so excited that you've agreed to be on with us today here at Soul Sciences.
Well, thank you, Charlene. This is really an honor for me, too. This is my first, so I'm thrilled and excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. That's a wonderful thing when I can be the first person that gives someone an audio presentation of their very important work. You've written a book. It's coming out in May, and the title is?
Summers of Fire, a memoir of adventure, love, and courage.
And this is based in your story of?
As one of the first women hired on a Forest Service fire crew in the mid-1970s. It's about my life at that time, and it does take me all the way to present time, not only just the adventures and the challenges of being a woman on a fire crew, but also the loves and the losses that I experienced during my career. It is not just for firefighters. In fact, I don't really think my audience will be firefighters. Everybody is going to find this, what I did, really interesting. I hope it's inspirational as well as eye-opening.
It sounds like all of the above, and I agree, this is not at all just for firefighters. In fact, I would say that it is specifically written for a more general audience, for the rest of us to know what it was like. And what decade was it, Linda, when you began firefighting?
It was 1976. And I did not know at the time that the Forest Service just started hiring women on fire crews. There'd been women in the past. You know, this is all stuff I find out later as I'm researching my book. There were earlier women, but the Forest Service did not specifically start hiring women on fire crews to fulfill minority quotas until the mid-1970s. So now that I look back, it's no wonder to me that the guys were looking at me like, huh, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
You can't do this. What are we going to do with a woman on the crew? I mean, it was, you know, they didn't know what to do with me. And I was just like, hey, I can do this work. But I had to prove that I could do that work.
Yeah, so true. You had to prove it. Did you do special physical building up of muscles to do this job?
Well, we were required to have, we had a fitness program that we did every day before work. We ran a couple miles and we did calisthenics. Fire crews don't do that. What we did back then. Back then, we didn't just sit around waiting for a fire. We had all kinds of projects to do, building fence, trail work. We stayed busy, and we used to swear, you know, why are we doing physical fitness if we hike, you know, 10 miles to work trails? There's our physical fitness, you know?
For sure.
So a lot of our work kept us fit. So, yeah, but there was, you know, we did work out every day, and that was part of our job.
What drew you to enlist in such a very physically demanding and dangerous occupation?
I've written another book, and it's a prequel to this one, where I get into how I made that decision, but basically what it was is that when we moved to Arizona from Syracuse, New York, in the middle of my senior year of high school, I couldn't find work after graduation. The Forest Service had a big presence in Prescott because Prescott sits in the middle of the Prescott National Forest. And I love to be outdoors. So I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to work for the Forest Service? You know, I get to be outside. You know, what a great job that would be. But that didn't happen. And I couldn't find work. And then my dad ended up in Tucson, Arizona, looking for a job because the one in Prescott wasn't working. And out of desperation, I went with him. I thought, well, certainly I can find a job in Tucson. And I wasn't having much luck because, you know, I'm 17, 18 years old, no experience. But one of his coworkers had a connection with the Forest Service, and they were looking for someone to work in the office up on Mount Lemmon, which is a mountain north of Tucson, in a ranger station. And I got the job. Now, it was an office job, but I was working in a ranger station in the middle of a pine forest, and I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I liked that job until I met the Catalina Hotshots, and they were an elite firefighting crew. And I dated a number of them. You know, I was young and single, and I had a wonderful time up there. And I watched what they did, and I listened to their stories, and I thought, that sounds like a job I'd like. And I applied for it and got it. I didn't get it up there. I got it down further south. I was working in the Santa Rita Mountains, south of Tucson. But yeah, it was just one of those things where I thought it was a good fit. And it was. It was exactly what I'd been looking for.
Isn't that incredibly inspirational that you just popped into it, as it were? You were meant to do this job, clearly. And you had no idea that you were breaking barriers for women.
I sure didn't. Not until the end of the summer. The 1976, the Forest Service initiated a program called the, well, not just the Forest Service, but the federal government. It was called the Federal Women's Program. And all of the women on the district were invited to this big powwow. It was a four-day event. And I still didn't think, I didn't even know what's the Federal Women's Program, you know. I had no idea. But when I got there to the meeting, And I'm so fortunate. I kept very detailed journals. So I even have journal entries of how many women attended that meeting. There were 37.
Wow.
And out of the 37 women, only three were on a fire crew. And I remember thinking, well, how come there's only three? And that was when I discovered, oh, because we're some of the first. Oh, my gosh. You know, so... And that was a real eye-opening experience because I found out that what they were teaching us as women working with men is how to deal with the men on the crew who didn't approve of us and how to be assertive, assertiveness training. I had no idea what assertiveness training was, but I learned all about it, you know, how to get what you want.
Was it helpful?
It was helpful. And what was funny, though, is that I didn't think I had a problem. I mean, some of the guys on my crew were chauvinists, and they would make, you know, really snide comments, and they made it hard for me. But the more they did, the harder I worked, and I just, these guys, you know, I can outwork them, you know, any day. So I wasn't worried about it. But it wasn't until further in my career that I would discover that I would be denied jobs for which I was fully qualified. And when you're told to your face by a man that you can't have that job because you're a woman, that really hurt. And that made me furious. And I fought those people, but there was no winning. Because although there were laws that said he couldn't say that to me, there were no witnesses either.
Right. And this is pre-iPhone, pre-social media. Everybody can be recorded in a given moment. This is before all of that takes place.
All that, you know, we're just sitting in his office and he's looking at me telling me, there's no way in the world I'm going to put you on my fire crew. You're a woman.
Those words ring in our ears. And at the same point, I'm hearing Harvey Weinstein with all of his awful, awful, awful sickness out there hurting women and hurting them and hurting them over and over again and getting away with it until the police actually put one young woman there on purpose, and she had a social media recording device. I couldn't tell you which one it was, iPad, iPhone, something, and recorded what he was saying. And then it started to be a compilation process. So we know for sure that as much as everyone wanted women to have equal rights, as much as we were stepping in that direction, the systemic oppression of women is still the day-to-day activity today.
Yes. That's what I'm discovering, you know, because women have made inroads into the Forest Service and in higher management positions. There are women forest supervisors now and fire management officers. But on the fire line, it's still the same women belong barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen stuff. And and women are hearing that today. They contact me and they tell me, you can't believe the stuff I'm hearing. And I'm thinking, I can. I just can't believe that I heard it 30 years ago and you still are.
So tell me, from your experience on the front lines with fires, is there a difference between, say, a young physically fit woman fighting that fire and a young physically fit man, same age, same ethnicity, however you want to make it a so-called equal playing field? Is there a difference? Because there's a lot of demand in fighting fires, is there not?
There is, and it's been proven that women are better at pacing themselves. I mean, the reality is, now, they don't do what we did back then. Back then, we would often be on a fire line for 16 hours straight, if not 24 hours straight.
Oh, my.
Now, they can't do that. You know, you have to take a break. But we would do that. And if you don't pace yourself, you're going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so you never know how long you're going to be on the line. So I learned very quickly how not to burn myself out too fast, because how in the heck was I going to make it through? If I was all burned out in 8 hours, what was I going to do for the next eight? But the guys tended to be real gung-ho, you know, and they would give it their all, and then they're dragging because they've burned themselves out. So I noticed, number one, that they tend to be a little careless with their energy, because we all have a limited amount. I don't care if you're 20 or 30, you know, which is usually about the oldest you are doing that work. But it's also a team effort. We work together for a reason, you know, that some people's strengths, male or female, can be in a different place. There can be men who are better at digging a fire line than one particular woman, but she's better at running the chainsaw. A good crew boss will make sure that each person is fulfilling a particular role on the crew that they do their best at. And then you have an overall crew that's superior. And that was the truth then, and that's the truth now.
Right. So you see absolutely no reason whatsoever. What about having periods? Can you have your period and fight a fire?
Of course you can. I did all the time. Now, you know, I was fortunate that when I was on fires for like 2 or 3 weeks, sometimes my period would just stop because I was working so hard that it would stop until I stopped working. I was like, well, thank you.
Exactly. That's nature. You know, that is nature telling us how to handle this excessive situation. My imagination and sense of humor says, yeah. And then I remember some periods where I would have liked to have had a hose on something. I was just not a very nice person. And I would have hosed down that fire real fast in my imagination, right? Yeah, to take it out on that, right? We know that men, in terms of their energy, tend to hit a wall. Athletes hit the wall. Women don't. And again, I believe it is nature's way of making sure that the babies are taken care of and that we can give birth and keep moving. Now, none of this cessation of your period stopped you in any way from anything else you wanted to do in your life. I haven't asked if you have children or didn't have children or.
No, I never had children. I did marry the person that I went to my very first fire with, but we divorced after 23 years. You know, and it was tough because when I stopped working, he continued. I mean, he still works for the Forest Service now. And, you know, and it wasn't my choice to stop working. That's just what happened. And
what happened then that made you stop? You mentioned an injury earlier.
Yes, it ended my career. And I ended up in college and getting 2 degrees.
Not a bad switch.
Yeah, it was hard for me to let go of that job, but I've always been very driven. And although I don't think so, I mean, I've had friends tell me, you know, what, you persevere more than anyone I know. And I'm thinking, no, I don't, you know, I guess I do. You know, it just takes me a while to get there to process. And just, but when I make up my mind to do something, when I made up my mind that I could do that job, that's what I did. And I did it for 7 years.
That's a long time to be fighting fires. I have spoken with other fire jumpers at different points. I lived in Boise, Idaho for quite a while. And right? A lot of firefighters in that range of the world. And what are your degrees in?
I have an undergraduate degree in landscape architecture and a master's degree in land planning. I am a landscape architect, and right now I'm self-employed. I do residential design in my community and teach classes on landscape care. That's been my field now since 1994.
It sounds lovely. It sounds like a lovely and very, very healthy and very, very necessary way to be of use in the world and to be really fulfilling your love of the land. Obviously, you love land and nature and all of that. Yeah. That had to have been part of your 7 years as a fire jumper, a firefighter.
Yeah, I just absolutely loved working in the forest. I mean, to me, you know, aside from the hard work, there was nothing like, you know, I mean, my day would be spent sitting among a forest and, you know, even if it was on fire, you know, I still felt quite privileged to be there.
Absolutely. And we just touched on this briefly in our pre-recording talk when I asked you about the terrible fires that have been raging. I think they're almost under control. Is that correct? In the north of California, or are they still battling?
They're still going. Some of them are about 50% contained, but some of them are only 10% contained, and they're expecting high winds. So all of that could change in a heartbeat. And watching this, I have never, ever seen this kind of devastation in residential areas. I mean, it just, I understand when fires get to 1 million acres in Alaska or Montana, you understand why, because you have all this contiguous forest. But you're talking right smack in the middle of California, in the middle of these big cities. And, but then you look at the resources, you know, there's only so many resources they have. And once you've got one house burning, okay, so you get one fire truck there, and then it sets four more houses on fire, and there's no more fire trucks. That's, I mean, I lay awake at night thinking of how hard this must be for the people that are there trying to get this under control, and they can't, because the reality is you can't. You know, they can't until it rains, or the wind stops, or the fire runs out of fuel. It's not going to stop.
And that you have seen firsthand, up close and personal, as they say, right? And the feeling on that must be just a devastatingly difficult one, a sense of despair, I imagine, and helplessness and hopelessness. And then those factors do come into play. The rains do come, the winds do die down, and then there's a reprieve. The other thing, though, I imagine, because as I say, I talked to a few firefighters and fire jumpers in Idaho, you could build trenches around the contiguous forest areas. You could wet down the trees on the outside. But if you're in a residential area, I don't know that they go around with hoses saying, we're going to just wet down your entire house right now so to protect it.
It is hot. A house fire, I mean, well, you know, a forest fire can get to 2,500 degrees.
Wow.
So you can imagine how little good wetting the trees would do. Because that would be evaporated in a heartbeat and it's gone. I had someone else ask me, why aren't they dropping more slurry, you know, the fire retardant? Fire retardant, the intent of that is only to knock down the fire long enough for someone to get in there, and in a forest fire situation, either to build fire line or to cut the trees down so that they remove the fuel. I mean, there's only three things that stop a fire. That's removing the oxygen, removing the heat, or removing the fuel.
Right.
You remove one of those three things and the fire will go out. Well, removing the oxygen in a forest fire, they throw dirt on it. You cool it down by dropping water on it, but you only cool it down. That's temporary.
Right.
And so even though they'll drop a load of slurry on it and it'll settle down for a while, but then if there's 2,500 degrees in there, it's going to evaporate that and take off again.
Unthinkable. And so what do you see as the particular difficulties in the residential areas around those three factors that would stop the fire?
Well, I mean, just the fact that you've got the intense heat. Now, when you've got a structure fire, and those burn completely differently from a forest fire, now you've got gas and electric, and you've got hazardous chemicals, you've got furniture burning, you've got I mean, that's why structural firefighters wear masks, because the air is toxic. And so you have all of that, you know.
I hadn't even thought about that, but that's so clear now. Yeah. really hard. So you would need to have every available resource from many, many areas in California and perhaps from out of state. I know that often firefighters go across state lines to help each other.
Yes, and I did too, But, you know, there's only so many people. I mean, you've only got so many trucks to bring water to. I mean, when you have, last count, 5,700 homes burned down.
Unimaginable.
It is. So you've got 10 fire trucks. You know what? I mean, really, what are they going to do?
That's so true. That is so true when you put it in that perspective. And I have, of course, seen some of the pictures. The phrase is well-worn, and we don't get the shock value, but it does look like the apocalypse. It looks like a movie set or something, right? It's just terrifying. And for the people who lived there and who are still, thank goodness, alive, for them to see that kind of devastation, I work a lot with trauma with people, helping them to release trauma safely and one stage at a time, having done that myself and been very successful at it, the number of ways to do it. But that has got to be a very traumatic impact to see everything you knew, everything you relied on as normal, go up so suddenly. I was just reading a headline that said that people went to bed quite naturally, and at 1 a.m. they woke up with this total chaos in every direction.
I've always considered myself somewhat of an empath, because I'm actually feeling what these people are feeling and how horrible that must be, and how many years it's going to be before that life is even remotely normal. It's going to be years. I mean, I'm thinking rebuilding all of these neighborhoods, or are these people just going to abandon them and go live somewhere else?
How do you start again? Absolutely. And I truly get what you're saying about the empathic capacity that we have when we open our hearts to realize what that extent of suffering is. How powerful that is, how dislocated these people. These people are effectively refugees in their own country, is how I see it, because we really do acclimatize. We know from neuroscience that we acclimatize very quickly. 20 minutes is all it takes. And we start to really bring in our environment. And then if we repeat that over and over again, we build neural cells, neural pathways that are recognizable as self. You see, as self, so where we live for a long period of time, who we hang out with for a long period of time, our brains incorporate that as a sense of self. And when that devastation is registering in their brains, in their consciousness, and thank God that most of the people, it seems, there were not that many deaths. I don't mean to trivialize the people who did lose their lives, but really, a lot of people got out. That's a great blessing. However, how do you rebuild that sense of self in a safe environment when you experience something that shocking that fast? It can be done. It definitely can be done, but it does take time, and it takes imaginative retraining, slowly releasing the fear, slowly releasing the shock, letting the body let go of it. And as the body lets go of those immediate impacts that right now these people can't possibly be dealing with, because they're dealing with survival issues. Where's the roof over my head? Yeah. Where's the food in my belly? What about my children? How are they going to go to school? Where are the clothes? These issues have to be dealt with first.
And that's the other thing. Schools are gone. Businesses are gone. These people don't even have a workplace anymore.
It is, from my perspective, unthinkable, and it is something we all have to gather around. Absolutely. Linda, this has been a wonderful talk, and you are deeply, deeply compassionate. Thank you for all the work you have done for so many of us for so many years, and that you continue to educate us about the power of the land and what is important in landscaping to keep in mind. And I look forward, would you come back another time and talk with us?
I'd love to.
We'll look forward to seeing you again, Linda. Bye for now. That's it. That's all for today's program. Thanks for joining us here at Soul Sciences. And thanks to Kevin MacLeod for that lovely intro and extra music called Carefree. For more of my work, please go to www.soulsciences.net. And remember, take good care of each other.